Hello everyone and welcome back to the In Your Nature podcast. I'm Ricky Whelan.
And I'm Niall Hatch, and this podcast is created in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Laois and Offaly County Councils with the support of the Heritage Council. This podcast is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly.
So we're back. This is season two, our summer season of the podcast. So we finished up our six spring episodes. They went down really well. We were delighted with them. So they've been sat there. People have been downloading. We're really, really happy with the feedback and how well it was received. So here we are again. We're having a second go at it now.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Always nice to chat to you, Ricky. And just to say thank you to everyone who's been listening to us and has been spreading the word about the In Your Nature podcast and has been sending us such lovely messages. It's nice to know there's actually people listening to us prattling on about birds and seemingly enjoying it.
So today, I'm delighted back talking all the species. I love all the birds, as do both of us, I suppose. But today we're talking about one that's particular got my affection, and it's the swift.
I'm with you there, Ricky. It's one of my favourites. The superlative bird spends more time on the wing than any other bird species. The most perfectly engineered flyer there ever was.
So tell me about that.
So swifts, for those who don't know, they are not a huge bird, but they're often very high in the sky, so you don't get to see them too well. But they have very, very long swept back wings, very finely pointed. They look like scythe-shaped wings flying through the sky. A cigar-shaped body, very tapered. They're very well-designed aerodynamically. In fact, they really resemble, in many respects, a fighter plane in the way that they're built, and that's no coincidence, because they are one of the most efficient body forms for cutting through the air, for migrating long distances. And really the only reason that they ever want to land is because they have to nest. Other than that, they wouldn't come to land at all. They don't really want anything to do with our world. They want to stay high in the skies above our towns and cities. They're with us here in the summer, and then they migrate down to Africa for the winter and just travel huge distances in search of food.
They're built for constant flight, basically, as you say, until they stop to breed. So they got that cigar-shaped body and that long, those sickle wings swept back, which is kind of characteristic of them. And they're essentially silhouetted against the summer sky. They look completely black. But in the hand, I suppose, they're a sooty grey or a very dark brown, with just a very slight white patch under the chin and a shallow forked tail, which is another design for the flight. But we'll probably hit on that a bit more in a bit. But they do get confused with a family of birds called the hirundines, which are your swallows and your martins. So in this country, we have the barn swallow, which everyone knows and loves. We have house martins and we have sand martins. So they're like those, but they're not related to them in any way. They're actually more closely related to the hummingbirds, which is a really interesting fact. So Niall, you might tell us about the differences between those four species in their appearance.
So I suppose in terms of the similarities, first of all, they are quite similar because they've all evolved a similar strategy. They migrate long distances. They have to chase flying insects in the air. So that's kind of why they look so similar. But what they all have in common is they all have, again, this sort of streamlined body, sort of swept back wings, and they all have a forked tail to some degree. But that's where you can really tell the difference. So if you look at the swallow, for example, it has a long forked tail with streamers coming off the corners. It's mainly white below, with sort of a dark band going across the upper part of the chest that's bordering a red throat. And from a distance, it looks like it's black above, but actually up close, you see it's this really wonderful metallic dark blue. So you see this white below, that's contrasting now to the swift, but as you said, is all dark, apart from that little white throat patch, but you'd hardly notice that unless the bird is very, very close.
You never even see it, to be honest. Until I seen one in the hand, I didn't realise they were there even.
Absolutely. And then when you look at the other two that you mentioned, you have the house martin and the sand martin. So they have forked tails. They don't have streamers, so they're like the swift in that regard, but they have lots of white below as well. So the house martin is almost completely white below, and then up above, again, it looks like it's black. Up close, it's actually a very, very dark metallic blue, and it has a big white patch very prominently on its rump, on its lower back. So when you see it flying away from you or turning in the sky, that's a very good sign that you're looking at a house martin there. And then the sand martin, it's a sort of a sandy brown coloured bird above, mainly white below, although it's got a band across the middle of its chest, which is brown as well. Again, like the house martin, they have a very shallow forked tail, so not the big streamers that we have on the swallow. But one of the big differences is that you will see the martins and the swallow, you'll often see them on the ground, walking, collecting mud to make their nests, and very often perched on wires. You'll never see a swift do that. They're not even capable of it. They have feet that are designed for gripping onto brickwork, and they will do that because they nest up, we're going to discuss, they nest up high up in buildings. Yeah. But the other ones are much happier on the ground, and they will often land and perch. Really, the only reason that swifts ever land is so that they can nest, and that's really it.
The other way of identifying whether you've got swifts or one of the hirundine species is by their nests. So their nests are characteristic to each of the species as well. So the swifts will nest in cavities in old buildings or walls or ruined castles or old Georgian buildings or old anything really where they can get a gap. Could be even a ventilation access or something like that, or boxes were provided for them. But swallows build those half-cup nests in the turf shed or in shelters like that. They're almost always inside or fully enclosed. Then your house martin is often high up on the gable of the wall under the fascia and soffit, and they've got a almost fully enclosed mud nest with just a tiny little sort of oval hole for them to come and go, really. And then sand martins, so-called, because they, traditionally at least, their main nest site is where they excavate little burrows into sand cliffs, either on the sort of corner bend of a river or in sand quarries, normally near very close to water or near to it. But they also, confusingly to a point, they will also go in cracks in masonry sometimes as well, especially near water, like quay walls are very good, or harbour walls and stuff like that. So I suppose the rule of thumb is if you can see the nest, it's not a swift nest, because they're always hidden away in those cracks or crevices. So they are a confusion species, and when you get those four species flying around at speed in the high up in the summer sky, it can be very, very difficult to separate them. So don't feel too sort of silly if you can't pick them out initially, but you will, once you get your eye in, you'll realise that the swift's wings are much longer, and that shape, that sickle shape, is very characteristic. And once you start spotting that and get your eye in, you're laughing. So tell me, Niall, where we tend to find swifts.
So swifts, they can occur anywhere, but they're mainly seen around urban centres. So around our cities, our towns and our villages, often high overhead where you have tall buildings. Now, they will travel long distances to find food. They catch flying insects and they zoom all over the place to find those. But they're mainly a bird that I would associate, in concentrations at least, with urban areas. So they're not a bird necessarily that you would see in big numbers over the open countryside. Whereas I would tend to associate the swallows, for example, although you will get them in urban areas, I'd associate them more with the countryside. So that's a kind of a distinction there as well, I find.
The two times I seen swifts in the last couple of days was in Mount Rath, where I live nearby, and also my hometown in Mount Mellick, which is a hotspot for swifts in County Leash. Actually, there's quite a few spots for swifts, so it was really good to see them screaming around the rooftops there this morning when I was driving through. So often, yeah, we call them sort of urban birds in that sense, but you do get them in small villages, and you do get them in the middle of nowhere in sort of castle ruins and fields and stuff. But the main clusters do tend to be in urban areas where they've evolved now to nest in man-made structures. And there are, like, over a millennia ago, most of them, before we start building things, they would have been in sea cliffs, in quarries, in crags and cliffs, and also in tree holes. And there's still remnant populations that nest in trees, and there's a small population over in Scotland, and there's some in the Belavezhia forest in Poland and places like that. But we don't know of any tree nesting swifts in Ireland at all.
Yeah, they're very much a bird that you would associate with high vertical surfaces, really, because the way that the feet of the swift are arranged is quite different from those of other birds. Birds like swallows, which are passerines, perching birds like others, they have a very standard sort of foot arrangement. Most birds have three toes forward, one toe back. They can grip and perch very well. With the swift, they have all four toes facing forward. That's great for clinging onto a brick, or suppose a cave or a tree, but it's no good for gripping around something or holding onto a perch like that way. Just a quick aside on that, by the way. When I was Googling to try and research for this podcast episode, I made the mistake of putting the words swift and feet into Google. I never knew there were so many websites devoted to Taylor Swift's feet. Just to put that out there, that's obviously
yeah,
a thing.
Right. You knew. That's in your favourites bar, I don't know. the feet thing is weird, but their Latin name or their scientific name is Apis apis, which means translates to without feet. Yeah. Which is confusing, but of course you just described it. They certainly have feet, but they've just evolved differently. So if they do end up on the ground, which is not their natural sort of territory, adult swifts can relaunch themselves. It's a myth that they can't, and people are going around trying to find swifts so they can throw them into the air and stuff. Juveniles, sometimes when they're not quite there, they do need a little bit of help, and you can pick them up on your palm of your hand and face them into the breeze, and hopefully they'll get going themselves. And if they don't fly after a couple of minutes, they probably need a bit of help from a wildlife rescue crowd or something like that. So that's just something to bear in mind. The other highly unusual thing about swifts is their screaming call. Mm. It's very noticeable. Let's listen to that now.
Oh, Oh, what a sound that is, Ricky. I love that. It's, it just reminds me of my childhood. That's the sound of Dublin City in the summer for me when I was a kid. It really is.
Yeah, but unfortunately, it's not really anymore. You can hear Swifts in Dublin City, of course. And we're surveying Dublin City Council's boundaries this summer to see exactly the extent of or how badly it's got and where the nests remain in the city. So looking forward to that challenge, but it's going to be a massive challenge in such a built-up urban area. But just touching on that now, we've seen declines in Swifts. Our CBS, which is Countryside Bird Survey, which Birdwatch Ireland coordinates on behalf of the National Parks and Wildlife Service, in less than 20 years, we've seen 58% declines in Swifts, which is just harrowing.
Well, that's massive. I mean, that's not sustainable. When you see a species declining that rapidly, you know, over such a short span of time, there's really, it points to something being drastically wrong. And obviously in Birdwatch Ireland, we're trying to get to the bottom of that and see what's happening. We know these declines are happening not just in Ireland, they're happening across the range of the Swift, across much of Europe and indeed into Asia as well, where it also occurs. There could be various factors, of course. Because this is a trans-Saharan migrant, it's obviously quite vulnerable to things like climate change, which are affecting the Sahara Desert. They're affecting the weather and weather patterns that these birds encounter on migration. They're affecting the availability of their insect prey. No doubt, intensification of agriculture must have played a role, but also lack of nest sites is a big problem, isn't it, Ricky?
Yeah, no, it's huge. So it would be agreed across sort of Europe with conservationists that Swifts have a housing crisis of their own. And the problem is modern buildings don't suit them. There's basically no opportunities for nesting Swifts in modern buildings. They've been shut out by modern building techniques and design and materials. So we now have passive houses, which wouldn't even allow a sort of bluebottle in, let alone a Swift or any other sort of large species. And we've renovated a lot of our old buildings and renovated Swifts out of them. And Swifts nest in colonies, so they like to be where other Swifts are. So you could have, for example, a large mill building or a warehouse on docklands or something like that, and it could have housed a Swift colony of 50 birds, and it then was renovated to apartments overnight and no one knew the Swifts were there, and they then got evicted from that building, and then you've lost a huge population of Swifts. Like 50 Swifts in a town is massive. It could be the entire population, actually. So, and you've lost the whole colony, and when you start getting local extinctions like that all over a county, before you know it, a county has no Swifts at all, and then you're really, really fighting. You know, you've got your kibosh to try get Swifts back, if at all.
Yes, because that colony aspect is absolutely vital, because we think of lots of birds as being very territorial, and you have a robin in your garden or a blue tit or whatever, a pair of them. They want to exclude all the others. They don't want them nest anywhere near. Now, Swifts obviously do squabble over nesting sites, and there is competition there, but they do like to be in close proximity to each other. And what really helps them is that if there's a thriving colony, that makes life much easier for all of the Swifts there, and therefore they have higher productivity and they do better.
It does. And like I say, they are social animals, but like you say, they do get into conflicts with other Swifts for nest sites, because nest sites are at a premium. So the good news is you can do stuff for Swifts and provide safe and permanent nest sites, but we'll get on that in a few minutes. I want to go back to just tell people how special they are and talk about how crazy their ecology is, that they spend life on the wing. And I just want to go into a bit more detail there. So Swifts can feed on the wing. That's pretty standard of hawking birds that hawk for insect prey. They're foraging on the wing, grabbing insects and all that. And they're designed for that. And I'll let you talk a bit more about the design in a second. But they can also drink on the wing. They can actually like swoop down so low on canals or a lake or whatever, a body of water, and scoop up a tiny amount of water from the film, sort of the surface layer of the water. If they get that wrong, they are in the soup and they are dead. So like they could be doing this at 80, 90 kilometers an hour. Like it's really, really something crazy to see. They can also mate on the wing, which is they're the only family of birds that do that, and it happens in an instant. And I've never actually observed it myself, but I think you have now.
I did. I've seen it twice, as far as I'm aware, and it really is over in an instant. You see the male and female coming up, and they just sort of basically touch against each other, and a bit of a flutter, and then fly away. It's all over very, very quickly. So blink and you'd miss it, and it's often at a great height. That's the thing. So I happen to be looking out from in a cityscape from a high window in a tall building, and I could see that happening. But from the ground, it'd be almost impossible to witness it.
Most of their life happens above us, where we just don't observe it at all. The other thing to do on the wing is they sleep on the wing, which is just bananas. And so unpaired birds and juvenile birds that have no nest space to roost in, or when they're in Africa, where they don't roost at all anywhere, they basically coalesce into these flocks at dusk, and they spiral up way up into the sky and disappear sort of hundreds and thousands of meters up into the atmosphere almost. And they go asleep. They switch off one side of their brain and they just drift around up there till morning time.
Yeah, and it's only in recent years that this has started to be understood, because if you think about it, how would you have known about this before? Without modern technology, there'd be no way to know what they're doing. But they have been able to monitor their brain activity, and it seems that swifts, like quite a few birds actually, they can indeed send one half of their brain asleep while the other one is awake, and therefore one eye is alert and watching for danger while the other isn't. And the interesting thing is that it's actually the right eye is controlled by the left side of the brain and vice versa. So when let's say the left side of the brain is taking snooze, then the right side is active, which means the left eye is active, which is pretty interesting.
When I first started with Birdwatch Ireland, I wasn't involved in swifts at all, and at the time Brian Caffrey was covering it all, and yourself and myself and Oren O'Sullivan were chatting about swifts, and I didn't know anything about them other than what they looked like, and they were cool and they kind of looked like swallows, and I'd seen them over in the UK where I had been living and stuff. But you and Oren start telling me about them sleeping on the wing and mating on the wing, and I thought you were pulling my leg. I thought it was the case of, like, when I used to work on the buildings when I was a chap, and they'd send me on fool's errands, like, you know, go get a bag of bubbles for a spirit level or a skirting ladder and all this sort of stuff. I thought you were trying to make an eejit out of me, but it turns out they're just amazing.
They are, and I love talking in schools about swifts, because they blow everyone's mind, and they still blow mine. I just don't know how they do it. So we were talking, first of all, about that body shape. They're so designed for the air that they've actually really sacrificed the ability to be on land. That's how much they want to be in the sky. They have these streamlined bodies. They even have recessed eyes to prevent any kind of drag, so they're totally aerodynamic. Yeah. They're amazing. And they spend the vast majority of their lives on the wing, and what really blows my mind is when you think of when they leave us here in Ireland. They're one of the first migrants to leave us, and one of the last to arrive. So the shortest amount of time really of any bird in Ireland. They come to us usually in May, and they leave us often in August. And when they leave those nest sites in August, they head down to Africa, and they will not touch solid ground again until they come back to your roof again, the nesting cavity, the following May. It's really amazing.
It is. That's at least 10 months in on the wing, right? Because they won't rest again until either they're in their nest site laying eggs or repairing the pair bond or whatever they do sort of in the early season. Or if they're sort of teenage birds looking for nest sites, they might just grab onto the wall for a couple of seconds just to see if there's a nest site in a crack or whatever like that. So they're just getting that couple of seconds of rest. But some people would claim that they're not actually mature enough to breed till they're two or three in some cases, and that they might never land at all for those 3 years. Now, we can't probably prove or disprove that, but it seems that they have the ability to stay in constant flight if they so wish.
Yeah, just think of that. Imagine flying for 3 years nonstop. And of course, that's their first flight, the first time they've ever tested their wings. So if you think of a bird like a sparrow or a robin or something, those young birds, their first flight when they've left the nest, it probably lasts a couple of seconds, ends with a crash landing in a bush, and they keep trying and trying to perfect it. What the young swifts do is, on an August evening when the weather condition is just right, they suddenly feel compelled to go to the edge of their nest and to just fall out of it. They let themselves drop. Some instinct tells them to open up their wings, and they've been practicing in the nest. What they've been doing is they've been doing push-ups on their wingtips.
Yes.
Which is something we've only found in recent years when cameras have gone into the nest. So they've been strengthening their flight muscles, and they somehow know to open their wings. The air current rushes over them. They have this amazing lift. It just picks them up, and they zoom up into the sky, and they head straight for Africa. They leave their parents behind. No one tells them how to get there. Off they go. And as far as we know, some of them may not land again for 3 years.
They're not following, like other species follow mature birds or experienced birds back to wintering grounds and all that sort of stuff, we know. And there's various ways of them navigating. But swifts, juveniles, just know they go because there's nothing here for them, because it's now late August. The insect population is starting to wane. It's gone past its peak. So they're looking for the endless summer. They're hightailing it back to Africa where there's the rains basically are. And after the rains is a profusion of insects where they can feed and stay in good health before they return themselves, hopefully, to breed up in Europe the following year. And it's truly amazing. And like you say, it's a really, really short window, and they really don't mess around.
No, it's really impressive. And also, when you see the parent birds going off to try and find food for their chicks, what they have to do is they have to fly sometimes long distances. It's suspected even sometimes, if the weather conditions mean they can't feed here, some of the adult swifts in Ireland may even go to France for the day to find food and then come back. And what they do is they collect this big bolus of squashed insects, basically, in their mouths, in their throats. And sometimes, if you're lucky, you can see them coming in with this bulging throat, and that's this ball of food to feed the chicks.
Bolus is crazy, and it can be made up to 1,000 insects depending on what it's made up of, and depending on the time of the summer and whether it's hoverflies that are on the wing or a lot of like biting midges or something like that, they won't waste time sort of selecting the tasty stuff. They'll basically grab whatever a lot of in the air column to feed their chicks. And like you said about other species, you know, learning to fly and all that sort of stuff, the blue tit or a wren is over and back to the nest to their chicks every couple of seconds with a new food item. The bolus only comes back, is dumped on the birds maybe once every 4 or 5 hours. And then they have this huge meal to deal with for the next couple of hours until the parents return again. So it's a really good adaptation. But they do look weird. It looks like almost they have two heads when they have a full bolus. And the other thing that sometimes happens is because the cracks and the crevices that they nest in aren't uniform and it could be a real tight squeeze, sometimes with a full bolus, the adults actually can't fit inside and they have to drop the bolus. And they've after wasting so many hours feeding, it's absolutely heartbreaking for them. And another adaptation they've evolved is a really good one, is that the youngsters can go into a state of torpor.
Yes.
For a couple of days, up to 48 hours, even more, if the parents can't feed them, if it's just really, really extreme weather, or it's just been a downpour and they can't get out and fly and find insects, because insects basically hit the deck when it's raining, they can't fly either. So they're just not out there.
Yeah, the young are actually able to lower their metabolism and their body temperature. It's almost what some animals do when they're hibernating, not to quite the same extreme, but they are able to cope with that so that they're not actually requiring so much food, so much energy to keep themselves going. And they can sort of kickstart their metabolism again when mum or dad comes back with the food. I think it's amazing. And the other thing, of course, that blows my mind about them too is that they build those nests inside the cavities. But of course, they don't land to pick up the material for those nests. Everything that their nest is built of is material that they've found in the air. It could be feathers or whatever, but they've managed to grab those in flight. They bring them in, they cement them all together with saliva that sets together like a cement to hold the nest together. And that's what they lay the eggs in. I find it really incredible.
The nest gets bigger over the years. So their first initial nest is literally just enough, a ring of feathers and bits and pieces to keep the eggs from rolling out, basically. And they'll add to it every year. So it would be a nest that's been used by a pair for maybe 8 or 10 years that looks like anything really at all. And then maybe their offspring from past seasons might move in there when they die off or whatever. So they can live up to 20 years, but they probably have, on average, maybe 6 or 8 breeding seasons in it, you know, with a good go at it. They only have one brood as well. Mm-hmm. So they really put everything into that. And they don't take any chances. You get other species which kind of have a scattergun approach. They have as many broods as they can and lay as many eggs, and hopefully they'll get a handful of chicks off. But with swifts, they go for one brood of usually 2 eggs, 2 chicks, and hopefully to God they pour everything into those on an annual basis and hopefully get 1 or 2 of those off. So that's their sort of strategy.
Yeah, it is actually interesting. If you contrast it with that with the swallow, which is you know, you think has a similar lifestyle, but actually it has a totally different breeding strategy. So they would have very often 2, sometimes 3, and maybe even 4 broods of chicks throughout the summer. They may have 8 to 10 eggs sometimes. So they're producing loads and loads of chicks, and yet still the mortality rate for those is extremely high. Most of those don't survive. So the fact is that the swifts, they tend to invest more in just in that one clutch, those 2 eggs that they have on average each summer. And that's their strategy to ultimately to have 2 to survive to adulthood, to replace their parents ultimately in the population. That's what it's all about, really.
I think we've established that they're the most wonderful species that there could be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Probably the only downside is that they're a bit sort of drab in colour. So if they were like a bit kind of multicoloured or something like that, I think they'd probably be the best bird in the world. I think it's safe to say that we want to save them and yep, they're worth saving. And here's where we come to the good news and the bad news. So the bad news is that we're seeing these 60% declines in less than 20 years. So that is severe. So we don't really know what the baseline was 100 years ago. I mean, no one was surveying these things. It's anyone's guess, but I think we can safely say, contradict me, Niall, if I'm wrong, but there would have been a handful of swift colonies in every town and village and scattered across our bigger cities back 100 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. And you think at the time there would have been a much bigger prevalence of insects. I mean, agriculture wasn't so intensive. There weren't so many pesticides. There were more farm animals and horses, especially around towns, would attract flies. And the building styles would have lent themselves very much to helping swifts. There would have been lots of nooks and crannies, places they could get in behind the brickwork, maybe behind the church spire or something like that, to find the perfect nesting cavity. And people would have associated them very much with their towns. They control the insect populations, things like mosquitoes would be kept down by them. So they were welcomed by people. But then, of course, things have changed since then.
Yeah, and we have managed to survey 11 counties for nesting swifts in the last 4 years. and we're doing three more this year. We're doing Dublin City Council's boundary, Kilkenny, and we're doing Waterford, which is great, with support from the Heritage Council and MPWS and the local authorities. But what we find in those county surveys is that in a very strong county, up to one third of the towns and villages we survey will have SWIFTs, but the other two thirds won't. But it's actually as low as one fifth of the towns and villages or localities in any. So they're really vanishing fast.
Yeah, they are. And like we were mentioning earlier, it's very hard to know exactly what's happening here. Probably many things hitting them at once. And we know that certainly these trans-Saharan migrant species do seem to be worse affected than many resident species or species that migrate a shorter distance. So climate change would seem to be a big factor there. But because of these really unique nesting habits that the swifts have, they're being hit disproportionately, I suppose, by changes to our buildings and renovations and modern building methods. And I think it really does point to that, because we're seeing problems with all sorts of birds, particularly with swallows. The declines are nothing like the same as they are with swifts. So it can't just be food supply. There must be more to it than that.
Yeah, totally. And so that's where we get to their conservation, how people can help. So swifts have actually got a lot of help because, I mean, all the reasons we've just described, they really, really attract a lot of people to get behind them. And we see swift conservation, Linda Huxley out west has done a lot of work on swifts. Like, before it was cool, Linda was chipping away at it, and now it's become so, I wouldn't say popular, but there's a lot of people involved now. And you've got the great work of our branches in Meath and in West Cork and in Kildare. You got Swift Dublin Swift Conservation Group, you got West Waterford Eco Group, Wild Kildare. So many people, I can't mention everyone in groups, doing an awful lot of work, not to mention tidy towns, individuals all over the place. And what they're doing, for the most part, is trying to help swifts out with the housing crisis, with their accommodation problem. And what they're doing to help with that is they're putting up specialised swift nest boxes and bricks and collar systems on suitable walls and buildings in their towns and villages and on their own properties to provide permanent, which is the key thing, permanent and safe nesting opportunities for swifts. And permanent is important because they are site faithful, as we've mentioned a couple of times. So they will come back to the same crack or crevice or nest box every year. So they will come back to the exact same place every year for as long as they live. So if they come back and you've just put up a box and you've decided to take it down the next year and move it onto a new tree or whatever for a blue tit, it's not a big deal because blue tits will travel and they'll find a new nest. But a swift will get very distressed, very confused, and it won't be able to find a new nest site probably for a couple of years, if at all, again. So it's really important, if you're putting up these swift nest boxes, that they remain there indefinitely, basically. So the choice of materials is very important there. So you'll hear a lot of the swift conservation advice will be about using permanent materials, like woodcrete is basically wood shavings mixed with concrete. It's guaranteed for 25 years, but I'm pretty sure it would survive a nuclear holocaust of some sort. They're the sort of ones, and concrete boxes are commercially available as well. That is not to say that if you can build a good, strong box out of marine ply or something like that, and you can put it up maybe under fascia and soffit where it's getting lots of shelter from the wind and rain, it's not getting much weather, that would be worth doing as well. There's no hard and fast rule there. But basically what I'm saying is, if you're putting up boxes, make sure they're going to stay there for a long time and they're good quality. Other thing is the collar system. So people are like, what's the collar system for? It's basically a little external speaker powered by an amplifier or any other sort of audio you can. I mean, you could stick your phone out the window if you liked and play the lure, but and it plays, or you play the duetting call of the swifts that we played earlier, and we can play it here again.
And that there, Ricky, you're saying about the duetting, that what's happening there is the male is calling and the female is responding instantly. We used to think it was the same individual bird making the same sound, but actually it's the male and the female sparring with each other or duetting.
So that's the duetting call. And then you're playing that through this little speaker on a sort of loop, and you can time it. We normally use lamp timers, just a very simple lamp timer, to play at key times in the morning for a few hours before dusk. And that's ideal. And hopefully what will happen is you get passing swifts from a nearby colony, or if there's none in your village, they might be flying over because they do get around the place. And they'll come down, they'll check it out, go, oh, there's swifts nesting here. And they'll realise there's vacant nest boxes, and they might come back, prospect this year, and then come back and nest next year. So that's what you're trying to do to attract them. So if it's a new novel site that swifts don't nest nearby, or they don't know about, the lures are really important, because it can definitely speed up how quick the uptake is. In some cases, swifts will never find the boxes without a lure, so it's a really good thing to do. One last caveat is you need a license to play a lure. It's free. It's a one-page application to the National Parks and Wildlife Service, and if you Google a lure license or whatever, you'll find it as well. So that, don't let that put you off, and you can actually apply and ask for that license for 5 years, because it can take a couple of years of playing the lure to attract them. So look, that all sounds a bit off-putting, but to help you with all that sort of stuff, Birdwatch Ireland compiled a load of information from experts in Swift Conservation UK, in Swift Conservation Ireland, and loads of other people that had loads of information out there. But we try to get it to one place, and we put it all in this guide called Saving Swifts, and you can download that free of charge on our website. So if you just Google Birdwatch Ireland Saving Swifts, you get that. And it's a very user-friendly guide on how you can get involved in swift conservation. It's very helpful.
And I think as well, it's getting into the mindset of wanting to save these birds, because I must stress there is no downside to having swifts around. They are remarkable creatures. They help to control pest insect species, which is great. But if people are worried that they're going to be messy, they're going to be droppings all over the wall, all over the ground, or all over your washing, when it comes to swifts, you have nothing to worry about. They are the cleanest birds going. So there's no reason not to have them around. They don't have a bad smell. They don't attract anything that causes disease. So there's no downside. It's almost stupid not to conserve them. There's no reason not to.
No, there's not. They actually carry the, what you described it nicely in a past podcast, the little nappies.
Yes.
That the chicks did. Well, they don't carry them away. They actually recycle them. They eat them. And see, they recycle the nutrients in the water from those. So there is no smell. There's no whitewash. There's no lots of bits, you know, on your windowsills. Swifts are easy. So the only really potential conflict is your neighbour giving out shite because you've played the lure on loop for constantly for 12 hours a day and it's going through his head or something. But sure, just we'll work that out. Cross that bridge when you get to it, I suppose, is the thing. So I think that's it. Look, everyone go out and download the Saving Swifts guide and get yourself a box or two, get them up in the house or the local library, or get involved in the local tidy towns and see what you can do. And that's swifts. And it brings us nicely now to our Bird of the Week section, which people also are liking and commenting on and looking forward to. So we've picked a nice species. Niall, what are we talking about this week?
Today we're talking about the house sparrow, another bird very much associated with our homes and our buildings.
Yes, and that is the link between the two species. And they also actually, would you believe, they compete for nest sites to a degree. Now, house sparrows nest as early as March, even probably late February, some of them depending in the cities and stuff. They will often actually use a site that swifts will later arrive to in mid-May and use as well. So you can actually have house sparrow nesting early in the season and then swifts. So don't get too uptight if there is house sparrows using a swift nest site. So house sparrows are cool. I really like them. Some people don't. They're a bit common maybe for people, I don't know.
I that's one of the things I love about them. I think that they used to be ubiquitous. And the fact is, we still have a reasonably healthy population of them here in Ireland. But especially in England and on many parts of the continent, the house sparrow has declined really very markedly in the last few years, the last few decades. And people who, you know, once were complaining about them, they just go chirp, chirp, chirp all day and they're boring. Now they really miss them because there's something very charming about them. I think, you know, we should cherish them while we still have them here in Ireland. Hopefully we will always have them, but we shouldn't take them for granted.
No, definitely not. And often it's an omen as to what's happening in the UK, what's going to happen here. So we should take that as, you know, advanced warning and keep an eye on them and be careful not to lose them. So they're great little birds. Like, I mean, I have them here in the house and they disappear actually here in the late summer, and they go, I think they go to the wider countryside or they find a local farm to eat the grain or the cereals or whatever, the seed. But then I get this gangle and they move back here in the kind of late winter, and they're very social and they seem to be breeding in a kind of loose colony. And the males and the females are displaying all the time, and they're really nice. They're it's like a soap opera watching them out in the air.
It is. They're a real little society going on there. You're right. They do have these sort of loose colonies. They kind of tolerate each other more than a lot of other birds. So if you look at the robin again, to use that example in your garden, robins seem to hate each other. They're really antisocial. The male and female come together to mate, of course. Takes two to tango and all of that. But the fact is, outside the breeding season, the male and female want nothing to do with each other, and it woe betide any other robin outside that pair that tries to come into that territory, because they will fight it and they'll even try to kill it. With the sparrows, they'll nest beside each other. Sometimes you'll see groups of them. It depends on how much food is around and what nesting opportunities are there. But they do have their own structure there. They have a hierarchy, and you have your alpha males, who are the dominant ones, who are bossy. And you can identify them yourselves because the size of the black bib that they have. So sparrows have, male ones do at least, they have a black chin and then this bib patch going down onto the upper breast. And on some of them it's quite big, and on some it's quite small. And that's all controlled by the amount of testosterone testosterone they have in them. So the larger the patch, the more testosterone and the more aggressive that male is and the more dominant he'll be in that little sparrow flock or society. And also the more attractive he'll be to the females. They like the males with the big patches. So it's all very macho behavior with it.
And you'll see the males almost kill themselves in some sort of avian yoga to try protrude that bib as much as they can. They kind of put their head back, their chins in the air, their beak sort of facing the sky, and they've got their wings stretched and their chest out trying to show the bib as much as they can. It's quite funny.
It is. They really do get into these contortions. There's a lot of competition there, and that's how they sort out this literal pecking order that they have. And another thing that I really love about them, when you see a group of sparrows together, they often do a thing that's called dust bathing. They'll get together where they find, especially on a dry day, if there's not too much water around, what they'll do is they'll go to an area of dust or maybe some dried soil, and they move around in it. They fluff it all through their feathers, and it'll leave a little depression in the ground if they continue to do that. And it's kind of like what they're doing is they're sandblasting their feathers. They're cleaning out any kind of dirt or parasites or whatever using this dust. And it seems that this is an evolutionary strategy that probably started either in the deserts of North Africa or in the Middle East, because that's where it's thought that house sparrows really evolved and originated. And there are many other sparrow species closely related to them that are still found in the desert regions of the world. And it seems that this particular species managed to expand into Europe and spread and multiply when humans started to get engaged in agriculture. They found that life around a farm where there was grain and where there were livestock, that really suited them. And then they could nest in and around our houses, and they became very tied to man. And that seems to be what happened. But they still have this sort of desert mentality. So they still do the sand or dust bathing to clean their feathers. And weirdly as well, they're related to a group of birds called the weavers, which are found in Africa and in parts of Asia. And weavers, they look like big sparrows, but they make a woven nest with a sort of roof on it that will hang down from trees and from bushes. I'm sure some people have seen them on some nature programs on TV. Interestingly, house sparrows, even though many of them now will nest inside cavities, inside a nest box, where they don't need to have a dome on top of their nest, they still build it because genetically they have that evolutionary memory of needing a roof on their nest, and they still do it, even though it might seem like a waste of energy and effort.
I only made that link myself with sparrows and weavers when we were on that work thing in Malta.
Oh, yeah.
And we went to that, they brought us to that woodland to see some birds, and hanging out of the trees, I don't know what sort of trees they were. Jeez, I really wasn't taking notes that day. But the Spanish sparrows, which are a very, very close relation to our guys, they just have a kind of darker head, sort of chestnut-y head. They were building very weaver-like nests hanging out of the trees. Like, they had the big round sort of nesting compartment and the little tube entrance hall to the nest, which is very, very similar to weavers. And then in one of our sheds, or on the of a kind of lean-to, one of our house sparrow pairs, they have a really, really, because they're normally in boxes here in our house and in cavities, but these guys have kind of nested between timbers. I think they think they're in like more enclosed than they are, but they've built this huge dome, which is very weaver-like as well. And I never really had seen a proper sparrow nest until those guys. And they nest there every year and they add to it and they're repairing it all the time.
Yeah, I think seeing that maybe even those nests have been used for many generations, that it's really that the structure will build and build. And I remember seeing in Extremadura in Spain, actually, a place where there's a village there where there's lots of white storks nesting on these poles. And what's happening is the house sparrows, they nest inside the nests of the storks that are up there on the poles.
Yes.
And underneath them. And you know what happens is obviously storks are a big, big bird. The young are in the nest. They're a bit messier than many other species. And so there's droppings around, and that attracts in flies and little maggots and things, which of course that the sparrows will feed to their chicks, because although the adults are mainly vegetarian, they eat seeds, they eat plant shoots, for the first few weeks of life the chicks need a high insect diet because it's full of protein to help them grow. And then of course as well, the very few predators are going to come and tackle a nesting pair of white storks, so things like sparrow hawks, which obviously would love to hunt sparrows, they're less likely to come close to that nest, so therefore the sparrows are getting the protection from the storks, which is really interesting.
Yeah, that's cool. And we have another sparrow in Ireland, and that's the tree sparrow.
Oh, yes, the tree sparrow, that's right. Yeah, sort of a more, but you associate more with rural areas, don't you? And it's not quite so commonly seen in much of Ireland.
No, but they're very simple. They are beautiful little birds, and they're tough nuts as well, but they're kind of like the country cousins, proper country cousins of our house sparrows, I suppose. They're quite beautiful, but people probably aren't aware of them. The last thing I sort of want to do is, before we finish up, is, because we always do, is I just want to play the song, which is basically just the call, the chirping call of the house sparrows.
sure everybody knows that. It's like the typical chirp of a little bird. And that's it. Yeah, no vocal gymnastics going on there. But the amount of chatter that they do, they must be conveying some sort of information. I certainly like to think that they are. It seems that there's a proper chat going on there.
They do. And they do those communal sort of chirps as well. They just sit in a bush, all of them, and they'll all just chirp away whatever they're chatting about. It's really nice. So next time we're going to be talking all about the Shannon Callows. Really, really spectacular habitat for birds and wildlife and plants especially. So we've loads and loads to talk about there. Looking forward to that. And we'll have an interview with Catherine Finney, a colleague of ours who was born and bred in the Callows and is a breeding weather expert. So she's perfect person to interview there. So looking forward to that.
Just to say as well, we were talking about the swift earlier. Just if people, when they see their first swift of the year, if you log them for us at springalive.net, we'd really appreciate that. People all across the BirdLife International Partnership are doing that. It's a wonderful initiative sponsored by Heidelberg Cement, and we're very grateful to them and to the coordinators who look after the Spring Alive project. So springalive.net for that. And also, if you've been interested in what we've had to say about conservation swifts and want to help BirdWatch Ireland to do that and to help us with our other conservation work, we'd love to convince you to become members of BirdWatch Ireland. So for full details of that, you can go to birdwatchireland.ie, click on the button there, become a member, pay your annual subscription fee, get our magazine, and feel good about all the work that you're helping to support.
Thanks, everyone. This podcast is made in partnership with Heritage Offices of Laois and Offaly County Councils, with the support of the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage, the National Biodiversity Action Plan and the Heritage Council. This podcast is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly.